Cynthia and Malcolm knew June of 2015 would be a trying time. Their sister Jackie had recently been diagnosed with cancer.
We thought it was stage 3 or 4 cancer. And so immediately Cynthia got into research mode in terms of, you know, researching what we needed to do, identifying a good doctor for Jackie, trying to put together a plan of action where we can help her from afar.
Cynthia asked if Jackie wanted her sister by her side when she saw the doctor. She said yes.
And she said, well, go ahead and find me a safe hotel to stay at, which I did.
Jackie would send her the address later.
The last thing she texted me was, okay, we got time. That was on June 16th. And she got killed June 17th. So that was the last text message, which I still have on my phone, that we had between each other.
June 17th was a Wednesday. That night, as she always did, Cynthia Hurd went to Bible study. Among the familiar faces of the congregation, people she knew well, was a stranger. When he came to the fellowship hall at Emmanuel AME Church, he was greeted with kindness. He sat, he listened, and he waited. When the parishioners all closed their eyes in prayer, he pulled out a gun and opened fire. 9, including Cynthia Hurd, were murdered that night. We know now Dylan Roof will die for his crime. A jury unanimously sentenced him to death after just 3 hours of deliberations. But while Dylan Roof started this story, his sentence or even his death will not end it. For the next hour, we will hear from those still coming to terms with their loss and from others trying to make sense of the senseless. This is Eyes Closed in Prayer. I meet Malcolm Graham and Jackie Jones as they leave the federal courthouse in Charleston.
Yes, I'm Gwendolyn. Hi, how are you?
This is my sister Jackie.
How you doing?
Hi, Jackie, how are you?
I'm fine,
nice to meet you.
Same here.
But their posture is drawn after listening to the first day of testimony. One of the survivors of the attack, a woman named Felicia Sanders, broke into tears on the stand. She described clutching her 11-year-old granddaughter while watching Ruth shoot her son multiple times. One of Ruth's attorneys objected to the show of emotion. That was too much for Jackie.
She's explaining what happened that night. She's living that night all over again, and you're upset because she's crying on the stand? I mean, where's your compassion?
We walk down the street to a parking garage and get into Malcolm's car. Jackie looks out on the city where she grew up.
It's weird. It doesn't feel like home anymore because, you know, the heart of our family is no longer with us. So, you know, when I come home, I can't go to her house like I normally do because she's not there. So it feels kind of weird being home.
She's staying at a hotel within sight of the Emmanuel AME Church. They know it well.
My mom and grandmother attended here. As kids, Cynthia, Jackie, and I, we went to Sunday school, bottom in the basement there. Jackie got married at the church. Our parents are buried in the church graveyard. So Emmanuel has been a part of our family foundation for some 50 years. And so it was no surprise that Cynthia was at church, went to that Bible study. And here we stand in front of the church right now on a Wednesday night. And obviously Bible study probably is occurring as we speak. The bottom gate is where you go into the fellowship hall.
The same gate Dylan Roof walked through that June night.
Please answer.
911, what's the address of the emergency?
Please, Emmanuel Church is plenty of people shot down here. Please send somebody right away.
As Roof fled north, his face was everywhere. TV, newspapers, the internet. Some 14 hours later, a Shelby police officer called this in to dispatch.
I know it's strange, but I just got a call on my personal cell phone. A lady called a friend of mine and said that she was behind a car matching the description of the Charleston killer. It had a South Carolina tag on it, white male, early 20s, with a bowl haircut.
Roof was soon taken into custody without incident. 2 days after committing his crimes, Roof stood shackled before a closed circuit camera connected to a courtroom.
Today is June 19th, 2015, Charleston County Bond Court. I'm Judge James Gosnell, the Chief Magistrate of Charleston County.
The judge asked Roof some basic questions.
What is your age?
21.
You're 21 years old. Are you employed?
No, sir.
You're unemployed at this time?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Then the family members of those Roof killed were asked if they wanted to speak. Some did, and what they had to say left many speechless.
I just want everybody to know, to you, I forgive you. You took something very precious away from me. I will never talk to her ever again. I will never be able to hold her again. But I forgive you.
You know, I forgive you, my family forgive you. But we would like you to take this opportunity to repent. Repent. Confess. Give your life to the one who matters the most, Christ, so that he can change it, can change your ways no matter what happened to you, and you'll be okay.
A moment of grace in the midst of pain.
We welcome you Wednesday night in our Bible study with open arms. You have killed some of the most beautifulest people that I know. Every fiber in my body hurts, but as we say in Bible study, we enjoyed you, but may God have mercy on you.
But a sentiment not shared by all.
A representative of the family of Cynthia Hurd.
When it was Malcolm Graham's turn, his voice was hushed.
We have nothing to say.
We have nothing to say is all he could muster. Graham doesn't regret that.
Some people's faith walk is a lot stronger and different than mine. But 2 days after the murder, my sister still was in a morgue. And I was not at a forgiving place then, and I am not at a forgiving place now. And certainly forgiveness is a journey. One first must ask for forgiveness, and then admit guilt. And he hasn't done any of that. He hasn't asked for forgiveness. He has admitted guilt with conditions. So I can't forgive him on behalf of my sister, those she died with, and for a race of people that he insulted.
Malcolm drives me to where Cynthia lived. It's a two-story house on a quiet street, the same house they grew up in. Even then, he says, Cynthia stood out.
Yeah, because we would be playing on the street on Benson Street, touch football, dodgeball, something like that. And Cynthia would be on the porch reading. And this was pre-intranet, right? And so Cynthia probably read every edition of the World Book Encyclopedias from A to Z. She was in the books. She was into reading and scholarship. And so she was our internet, because
every book of the encyclopedia.
She knew it. And so when we needed something, research papers, when we were in high school, or we just go to Cynthia.
Some kids would tease her for being a bookworm, but that, he says, didn't bother her. Cynthia always had a way of seeing the best in people and seeing their potential even if they didn't see it in themselves.
I remember a conversation we were having, and she asked me what I wanted to do. And I guess I had to be in elementary school. Who's thinking about that, right? And I said, I want to be a truck driver. And she said, you can do a lot better than that. And, you know, growing up in Charleston in the late 70s, being a young guy that was, you know, pretty smart in school, that wasn't the way to gain friends, you know, because, you know, you want to fit in with everybody else. And she reminded me that being different, being smart, was not a bad thing, and that I need to kind of grow to my fullest potential.
Malcolm went on to become a successful businessman, Charlotte City Councilman, and state senator. Cynthia followed her love of books and became a librarian.
A typical day for her for 16 years was working at the Charleston County Library from 8 o'clock to about 5 o'clock. Then she would go to the College of Charleston Library, where she would work at night from 6 to about 10:30. And she did that for 16 years.
Every day.
Every day. Maybe a day or two off at the College of Charleston. And she didn't do it because she needed the money. She did it because she loved being in the environment of the library.
And she didn't just tend the stacks.
The kids knew her. The local vagrants knew her. They all knew not to come to this library and cause any trouble because Mrs. Hurd was in charge.
Oh, my. A vibrant mural of books now graces the library Cynthia Hurd cherished as a child and ran as an adult. It's dedicated in her memory. A second library now bears her name. But tributes to the life Cynthia Hurd lived go far beyond brushstrokes and buildings. Like most of us, Eric Davis learned of the killings on the news.
Like the first thing that morning when they first started naming the victims, and I was like, oh man, Cynthia Hurd. And I didn't realize it at first, and then when they put the picture up, I was like, I just saw her. And yeah, it hurt. It really did hurt.
The 22-year-old had known Cynthia Hurd for years.
She was actually my manager for my first job, my first summer job. I was working at the library, and I actually grew up going to the library, so I already knew her personally. And working for her was probably one of the best jobs that I ever had.
Davis would run errands, do odd jobs. On days when he didn't have money, Cynthia would buy him lunch. Even after Eric Davis took another job, Cynthia Hurd would check in on him.
I actually saw her 2 days before the shooting happened. So I was working at Walmart at the time, and she came in there, and we talked about for about 10 minutes about me getting ready to go back to college and everything.
But at the time, Eric was only attending occasional classes. He had no plans to return full time. That changed the day Eric Davis heard that Cynthia Hurd was gone.
Just knowing that she passed, like, I felt like that was more motivation. I don't want to let her down because she told me to make sure I finished school. And not finishing school, that would be a letdown. So I can't do that. That would eat me away for years and years, and I can't have that.
Davis re-enrolled in college, did well enough to earn a scholarship. He will graduate with a degree in graphic design. His life, just one piece of Cynthia Hurd's legacy. Brittle Bank Park is within walking distance from where Malcolm Graham and Cynthia Hurd grew up. First as children, then as adults, they would go to the park and talk. He can still feel his sister's presence.
I can see us on that bench right now talking, and her saying that her death really wasn't about her. She would say that her death and the death of the eight others was really about a race of people. About the Christian church and about people being in touch with their humanity. And that 250 years of suffering at the hands of some white folks who despise African Americans based on their skin color, that it simply can't be about just denying folks who died, that we need to broaden the conversation, that this is about how a race of people in 2015 are still being seen as someone being less significant, less important, and that their killing is accepted in some quarters.
Malcolm Graham's view on what happened that night is crystal clear.
What occurred that night was that nine people lost their lives simply because they were black. Five other were terrorized simply because they were there. And the community will never be the same because it happened.
Strangers are still welcome to attend Bible study at Mother Emanuel, but now they have to be buzzed in. And although its address has not changed, the section of Calhoun Street in front of the church has been renamed. John Calhoun was a proud supporter of slavery. That stretch is now known as Mother Emanuel Way Memorial District. On a recent December morning, two women, both professional gardeners, were hard at work outside one of the grand homes on Charleston's Battery Park.
And we're planting and covering flowers today for the freeze that's coming up tonight.
That's Jennifer Stringer Obie. The killings at Mother Emanuel have caused her to think long and hard about a difficult subject, race and racism.
It has. It definitely has. I feel like I'll never understand what it's like to be a minority. And I do have that privilege. So if I can help others understand that, you know, everybody needs to feel equal and just communicating and just being kind to others, because I just feel like we have to set that example.
Alongside her works McKenna Perry. And Perry says she has a gripe with the coverage of the Dylann Roof trial.
Even throughout the journalism, the newspapers, and the TV articles that I've seen, journalists still seem to be really shedding light on the fact that he's a young white male from elsewhere. And I wish that they would bring a little bit more humanity to the subject and maybe just realize that it's not just Dylann Roof and it's not just a white male, it's not just a black male. These are actual people with names and faces, and because we're still talking about white men and black men as opposed to people.
Up next, the trial of Dylann Roof and the story of another family torn apart, then rebuilt in a new home.
For me, I'm a work in progress, and I acknowledge that I am very angry, but we are the family that love built.
You're listening to Eyes Closed in Prayer. This is Eyes Closed in Prayer. I'm your host, Gwendolyn Glenn. On a recent afternoon, Ed Brosh sat on a wrought iron bench next to a friend. Brosh is from North Carolina, visiting Charleston to take in the city's history. By chance, his visit coincided with the start of an historical trial. Dylann Roof is the first person to be sentenced to death by the federal government for committing a hate crime. Ed Brosh certainly approves.
I mean, it's a hate crime committed on innocent people. That asshole that committed this horrendous crime should be punished to the full extent of the law. I think that the death penalty in this case is definitely warranted.
Justice, Brosh said, should come swiftly.
I don't think it should be dragged out. saving taxpayers money for something that's as cut and dried as this, a heinous crime that he's committed.
In the end, the trial lasted 13 days, pre-trial motions and jury selection a few more. And every day court was in session, Alexandra Olgan was there. She's the Charleston reporter for South Carolina Public Radio. Throughout much of that time, she tried to get a feel for Dylan Roof. She says it was harder than you would expect.
During the actual guilt phase of the trial, when he was being represented at that point by his attorneys, he really didn't do much. He just kind of sat there and looked straight ahead. He didn't really show much emotion, at least from my perspective, watching him from the courtroom.
Did that change at all when the family members demanded that he look at them?
No, and that was the thing. The family members kept trying to get his attention and kept trying to force him to look at them. Now, some claimed that they saw him glance up or they felt his breathing change when they were talking, but we didn't really see much of any kind of reaction from him.
The jury found Roof guilty on all counts, a verdict never in doubt. Next, the jury had to decide if Roof would be put to death, and that's when Roof's persona changed from a stoic, emotionalist defendant into something far more complicated.
We hadn't heard him talk at all, and then finally, when he decided to represent himself and he actually started speaking, it felt like this change where he felt a little bit more human because he was now actually talking and we heard him, his voice.
Audio recordings aren't allowed in federal court, but Olgan remembers Roof as being shy, bashful even, more comfortable talking to the judge than the jury. There was more of these brief glances into Roof's mind. There was a journal penned in his cell where Roof said he hoped his crime would not affect his family.
So it's clear that he is capable of feeling, having feelings towards someone or something. He also talked about how he never fell in love, and that's one of the things he regretted. So again, that shows that he is capable of having those emotions.
But Olgan adds that same jailhouse journal showed an abundance of hate.
At one point, he wrote that he did not feel bad for what he did, and he wanted to be crystal clear about that. Those were his words. And he also said he had not shed a tear for the innocent people that he killed.
And innocent people. Those were his words.
He talked about Black people. He talked about Jewish people. He talked about Slavs. He talked about Hispanics, how he doesn't like homosexuality. He doesn't like feminism.
Roof's journal was so damning, prosecutors simply had it read out loud in court. On the day the death sentence became official, Grayson Doctor stood up and addressed her mother's killer directly.
She said, "I think that what you did is the one sin that she's not even sure that God could look past." And she said that she hopes that he goes straight to hell.
Her aunt Bethane Middleton Brown had even harsher words.
Yeah, she had a very emotional, empowered speech. She got up and said to Dylan Roof, "You may have killed my sister, but, she's an angel." And then Bethane also talked about how she was searching for the worst term that she could use to say to Dylan Roof, and she couldn't come up with the right word, so she just didn't even go there and didn't try and find a word to call him.
For relatives of the victims, the weeks and months after the shooting have featured a series of journeys, each one an incremental step. They are journeys of grief, uncertainty, and resilience. For Bethane Middleton Brown, Grayson, and her siblings, it's also about discovering new ways to define family. They all now live here in Charlotte, and 1 year after the shooting at Mother Emanuel, they share their journey with Mark Rumsey.
It's a pleasant early June morning as a colleague and I walk up to the two-story home on a winding suburban street on Charlotte's north side. But an awkward feeling goes with me. I'm about to meet three living victims of violence. They are a daughter, a sister, and a niece.
Hey.
Hello. I'm Mark.
Hi, Mark. Come in.
Hi.
Bethane. I'm Bethane. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Already, I feel welcome in the home that Bethane Middleton Brown shares with her family.
Grayson, this is DePayne's eldest daughter. The others and we're going to be here.
Hi, Grayson. I'm Mark.
Bethane is the younger sister of the Reverend DePayne Middleton Doctor. She was among the 9 parishioners killed at Charleston's Emmanuel AME Church on June 17, 2015.
Dogs outside.
As we settle in around a tall kitchen table, we're joined by Bethane's 19-year-old daughter, Jillian, and by Grayson, age 23. She's the oldest of DePayne's 4 daughters. The 2 resident dachshunds, now exiled to the backyard, still serve to help break the ice.
They remind me of me and my sister. Yeah. Because Sophie is very girly, you know, she's very particular, and Nikki is hyper and everywhere. And that was me as a kid, so. And my sister was more reserved. Yeah.
DePayne Middleton Doctor was the middle child of 3 daughters born to the Reverend Leroy and Mrs. Francis Middleton. The girls grew up attending an African Methodist Episcopal church west of Charleston, their father, an AME minister. But when DePayne eventually discerned her own calling to ministry, it led her first to a Baptist organization, where she became an ordained reverend. It wasn't until March of last year that she joined Charleston's historic Mother Emmanuel Church and pursued ministry credentials from the denomination of her childhood, as daughter Grayson explains.
She had to pretty much go through the whole procedure again. So even though she was an ordained reverend, she now had to become an ordained reverend in the AME church. And that's what she was going through. So on that Wednesday night, that was completed.
The Wednesday night that Emmanuel AME became a killing ground. Over the past year, it has annoyed Bethane Middleton Brown when a media mention of the 9 Charleston victims has failed to include the title reverend when referring to her sister.
DePayne was an ordained minister long before she went to Emmanuel AME Church. And once there, when she left this world, she was an ordained minister. And I find that that's the biggest pet peeve I have, is that I want her title to be there because she earned it.
The Reverend DePayne Middleton Doctor was 49 when she was killed. In addition to Grayson, the tragedy left 3 other daughters without their mother, Kaylin, now 18, Haley, 14, and 11-year-old Zaina. Last fall, Grayson began her senior year at Johnson C. Smith University in Charlotte. Kaylin enrolled as a freshman at Johnson and Wales University, and their Aunt Bethane went to work seeking and eventually gaining custody of the 2 younger sisters. DePayne and her husband had divorced in 2012. Bethane was determined to keep her nieces together.
She loved her nieces and nephews. She loved her children. She's the best big sister I could ever have. She never waited for me to ask for anything. I would get care package and my other roommates would be jealous. That was her. She was just really very nurturing to me. Very nurturing.
So it's June, and I wonder what June is feeling like to all of you.
I'll let you start that.
It's better than last June, but, you know, it's still a process. So, I don't know. The days are just, they're just kind of going.
I was real moody. Couldn't figure out, you know, it dawned on me at first, and then I started to, Haley asked if we were going to go to church, and we went, and that's when I kind of realized, you know, it's getting closer. So I go between sentimental and mood swings. Yeah.
Did something trigger that?
There's a pause as Bethane gathers herself before responding, and Grayson reaches with a reassuring touch to her aunt's arm.
Just before you came, I said I was already feeling very emotional, but one of the things is I keep thinking back to my family and I, my husband and my children. We got baptized on
December. It was Christmas Eve of 2006. And when I looked up in the balcony, my sister was there. And she was looking down, smiling and waving. She was real happy because that was something she wanted for a while, that we would get back involved in church. So when I go to church, I try not to look in the balcony. And
Bethane explains that on this recent Sunday, something, maybe an amen from the balcony of her home church in Charlotte, caught her attention. Then, suddenly, at this reflective moment in our kitchen table conversation, the mood takes an unplanned turn.
It's my...
The crashing sound is a decorative frame falling from a wall behind us in the stairwell of Bethane's home. She takes it as a message.
That's the pain. Because we put a picture up and we said, with our luck, it will fall down during the interview. So, but the only hard thing that's a trigger, I'm glad it failed, it made me laugh, is just... because the pain, that was her stomping ground, church and her singing and being in the choir and being in the pulpit. And when I would go to church, I would come back home and we would talk about when I went to church. I'm like, girl, you won't believe he did it this time. You know, I would tell her what the pastor preached. And it sparked long conversations between her and I. So I miss that. I miss not being able to call her and share what we call our time, you know.
And everything that each of you has been sharing gives me the sense that your sister, your mother, your aunt was a really strong presence.
Mm-hmm.
She was. She definitely was.
That was our glue.
Yes, mm-hmm. She was. She was definitely the person to hold everyone, bring everyone together. Mm-hmm. Everyone depended on her. We all leaned on her for everything. Like, I just feel like she was the go-to person for everything. For everything. No matter what.
Her family also remembers the Reverend DePayne Middleton Doctor as a woman who put music into their lives, writing and singing songs since childhood, says Bethane.
The first song, she wrote a song back when, and we used to sing it in the when we take our shower, our bath. So I think she might have been 10 or 11 when she did When We Get to Heaven. And she's been writing ever since.
Grayson adds her mother was always singing, in the kitchen, in the car. And her powerful singing voice can still be appreciated, as in this recording. With the South Carolina Baptist E&M Convention Choir behind her, DePayne Middleton Doctor proclaims the faith that meant so much to her. For Bethane, the journey into a future without her sister seems to have taken on a gentle rhythm.
I started out saying one day at a time, but I'm back to one breath at a time. And I'm comfortable with one breath at a time. So I still am a work in progress. My intentions are still to find forgiveness. I'm still angry. I have hope, but that's where I am.
Was that painful in any way to hear a level of forgiveness or a stage of forgiveness being expressed by some others that didn't seem to match where you were in that process?
It wasn't painful. The only painful thing at that point for me was that I was trying to come to terms with the fact of what had happened to my sister. My intentions, I don't think I'm a bad person. I think I'm a forgiving person. I may not get there when everybody else does. I don't really give a thought to my sister's murderer, and I don't call him by name, and I gladly say I call him Lucifer.
because I think that that's what was the spirit that took over him to make him do something as horrific as he did.
Charleston obviously now holds sharply contrasting memories for DePayne's family. But for Bethane and Grayson, other visits over the past year back to the charming city where they both grew up seem to have brought more comfort than pain.
I don't know. I was sad at first, but then it was just beautiful. It was such a beautiful day. And I remember saying, Charleston is so beautiful. It was just so beautiful. I could see the church steeples, and the Battery, of course, wasn't far away. The carriage rides were coming through, and it was just a very serene kind of atmosphere that I felt.
At first, it was hard because I'm so used to going home, you know, of course, to having my mom there. And I was also thinking it was going to be hard every time. Every time I go back, I'm just going to, don't want to go to Charleston. But it's been the opposite. Like, I get excited to go home, and I definitely feel a sense of serenity when I go there, too, especially when I'm downtown.
Less than a month after the massacre, the Confederate flag was lowered for a final time from its pole on the State House grounds to a chorus of cheers heard well beyond the Capitol. Bethane says taking down the flag was a good move for race relations in the country, but she adds,
I question if it's going to stay that way or will it return. It is my hope that it won't return, that it will stay showcased wherever, and that we will continue to move forward with an effort to improve race relations. I'm a little iffy with race relations because it seems like it just keeps flaring back up.
Like her aunt, Grayson isn't convinced the Confederate flag is gone for good.
I'm not going to say, you know, that we're going to see the flag up on top of the State House again, but who knows? I just, you know, especially with governor changes, you just never know people's mentality, their way of thinking, you know, their background. You just don't know what people could do.
Grayson adds the country can move past its troubling race relations only when people accept the fact that racism still exists.
I think people are in such denial and, you know, they just don't want to face the fact that it's happening. Maybe because, like, it's not something that they've experienced personally.
After the break, the power in symbols of love and hate, and an unexpected irony in Dylann Roof's crimes. You're listening to Eyes Closed in Prayer. You're listening to Eyes Closed in Prayer. I'm your host, Gwendolyn Glenn. Less than 24 hours after committing mass murder, Dylann Roof sat in an interrogation room in Shelby, North Carolina, where he was captured. Two FBI agents began questioning Roof.
Can you tell us about what happened last night?
I went to that church in Charleston, and
there's a long pause, a short exchange, and then Roof says, With a confession quickly in hand, the agents began filling in details. How many bullets Roof brought with him? 77. The type of gun he used? A Glock 45. Roof drew the layout of the room showing where the parishioners were seated and described how he went around the room.
I was just sort of pacing around, you know, because I was like freaking out a little bit too, you know what I mean? It's not, there was pauses in between, and he was thinking about, you know, what I should do and stuff. But I guess in a way.
For nearly 2 hours, Roof answered questions with a nonchalance more fitting someone describing a non-eventful night.
Or let's say that, say a black man walked into a church and killed 9 white people. What should happen to him? You already know the answer. Just tell us. I mean, I can see by the look on your face you already have a thought. So what was your thought on that when he asked you?
Well, you should probably die too, I guess.
Dylan Roof is a racist, though he prefers the term white nationalist, and to Roof, symbols of white supremacy held power. The FBI agents found a picture of Roof wearing a jacket with patches of the Rhodesian and apartheid South African flags. They asked why.
Well, because they represent white people ruling in the homeland of Africans and ruling as minorities.
Ruling as minorities?
Yeah, that's powerful.
They also found an image with the numbers 14 and 88. 14 is the number of words in a racist credo Roof knows by heart.
We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. That's the 14 words, and then 88 stands for Hail Hitler because it's H-H.
H is the eighth letter of the alphabet. Roof's understanding of the power of symbols is also why he chose Mother Emanuel. A chance encounter let him know when he should strike. On an earlier trip to Charleston, Roof talked to a parishioner outside the church.
I just asked him, I said, when is the church service? You know, and then she told me the church service and the Bible study or something like that, the times or something.
Was that an African American?
The internet taught him the Emanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church was an historic black church, a powerful symbol of a community he despised.
This is a church that is not only well established, but was very, very instrumental in the abolitionist movement, was very instrumental in trying to push against the Jim Crow, and also was very instrumental in the civil rights movement.
Herb Frazier is co-author of We Are Charleston, a book which chronicles the history of Mother Emanuel, known by that name since it was the first black church in the South.
Well, when the church was established, of course, it was in the presence of a slave-holding society. And so the idea of Africans being able to worship and meet on their own without some oversight and restrictions by the white authorities was sort of didn't fit in a slave-holding state. So they were subjected to raids, arrests, harassments, and eventually the church was forced to go underground to have clandestine meetings. And, of course, one of their members was Denmark Vesey. Denmark Vesey in 1822 was accused of leading or attempting to lead a conspiracy to overthrow the white authorities, kill as many whites as he could here in Charleston. So that was the conspiracy. He was and his fellow co-conspirators were arrested, executed, and the church building was destroyed. The church went underground, and the church was not able to resurrect itself until after the Civil War. So that was the first tragedy that the church experienced.
And others?
After the church was established after the Civil War, the church was heavily damaged in 1886 during a very devastating earthquake. And a new building was built at the current site.
When you look at those past tragedies and when you look at this tragedy, do you see major differences in the effect on the church?
One tragedy, of course, was by the hand of man, and they overcame that. The other tragedy was the tragedy of Mother Nature, and they overcame this. This current tragedy, obviously, is by, again, the hand of man. We say in the book, we are confident that the resilience of the church has been displayed over the history of the church, and we are all very confident that the church will heal and will resurrect itself in the wake of this current tragedy.
It didn't take long for images of Dylan Roof posing with a Confederate flag to begin circulating, which is why 10 days after the massacre, one woman felt the need to do something.
It was very difficult because I couldn't tell my family what I was doing.
Bree Newsom is a civil rights activist who lives in Charlotte. Newsom and a friend drove to the South Carolina Capitol in Columbia, and in the early morning light, she scaled the flagpole and removed what she saw as a symbol of hate, the Confederate battle flag.
You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God. This flag comes down today.
Not long after, Newsom described what went through her mind as she climbed the 30-foot pole. She spoke with reporter Sarah D'Elia.
Just very focused on the task of hand as I was climbing up, because I got to make sure that I'm safe. I wanted to make sure that, you know, everything was remaining as calm as possible. So I was constantly also talking with the police and just letting them know, like, this is a peaceful action. I didn't want anything to escalate. And then once I climbed up and unhooked the flag, I was first just taken aback at how simple it was to just unhook the flag and take it down. It's quite a simple act. And just really feeling this personal sense of triumph and of having overcome my own fears and the fears that, you know, had been aroused in me by the Charleston massacre and just by what this symbol represents.
What has surprised you the most?
I honestly didn't expect people to view it quite as historical, primarily because as soon as we were, you know, down in the jail, within 45 minutes, we were told that the flag was back up. So I was, you know, down in jail assuming that maybe it hadn't made much of an impact at all or much of a statement at all. And so then once I got out and saw how much it had resonated with people, I was really kind of surprised, honestly.
There's been a range of reactions to you scaling the flagpole and bringing down the flag. And some of them have been positive. A lot of them have been positive, especially locally here. Some have been negative. And some have been kind of in the middle. There are a couple of tweets that I want to read. One is from Senator Marlon Kimson of Charleston, and he said, there are two ways the Confederate flag can be removed forever. Citizens, please enact legally or we lose. How do you react to those tweets? I mean, was this the right thing to do?
Quite frankly, to be blunt, that's a bit like saying that Rosa Parks, by refusing to get up from her seat, was making it harder to integrate the buses. I mean, that's just, I don't support that logic at all.
Which leads us to an irony in Dylann Roof's crimes. He hoped it would start a race war. Instead, it accomplished something decades of protest and boycotts could not. A month after the killings, the Confederate battle flag was permanently removed from the grounds of South Carolina's Capitol. Reporter Tom Bullock watched as it came down.
The flag ceremony was due to begin at 10 a.m. It ran a little late, and some of the crowd of more than 1,000 grew restless. Regina Brittingham was watching it all.
It's just good to see everybody of all race, religion, come together, and that makes you feel good.
Brittingham was there with 4 generations of her family to witness something they'd long hoped would happen. Not far away stood Joy Jackson, draped in a Confederate flag.
I do not think that flag should come down. It wasn't about slavery to begin with, and it should not come down. But at least I can do is come wear the flag to represent my grandfather.
Who was injured, she says, fighting for the Confederacy and what he believed in. At 10:05, both Jackson and Brittingham watched as 7 members of the South Carolina Highway Patrol Honor Guard, wearing crisp gray uniforms, silently marched to the foot of the state capitol building. They turned left in formation, marched across the grass of the capitol grounds. Then, ceremonially, they lowered the Confederate flag, folded it, and marched it away to be placed in a nearby museum. People then began another chant. And that was it. No speeches, no politicians, no bands. But the simple ceremony belies the importance of the event.
I think it's a very big deal. It's been a contested issue for virtually my entire lifetime as a native South Carolinian.
Lacey Ford teaches history at the University of South Carolina. He, too, watched the furling of the Confederate battle flag today and the flurry of political activity in the past few weeks that made it possible.
The modern flying of the Confederate flag on the Capitol Dome began in 1961 with a commemoration of the Civil War centennial in South Carolina. And I believe that the original intent was that the flag would be up there during the 4-year centennial and then be taken down. But as we all know, that's not the way it ended up.
Because the Civil War centennial coincided with the Civil Rights Movement, Ford says there are bigger issues than the flag. He says removing it is an important symbol, but it doesn't end racism.
I would not go so far to say that we're beyond it or past it or that it won't claim its victims in the future and that unfairness and inequality won't continue to exist and have to be struggled against.
For some, that struggle has made them activists, their groups made famous on social media. Others, like artist Sonia Clark, felt a need to do something more tangible. In a piece titled Unraveling, Clark shows people how long it takes to deconstruct a complicated symbol of American history. Reporter Sarah D'Elia has her story.
Much of Clark's work is focused on civil rights issues and struggles. Her piece Unraveling takes the Confederate flag and its complicated history head-on. With the help of family members, friends, and even strangers, Clark sat in front of it and slowly unraveled the flag. It's a tedious task. Partially intact and partially in threads, the flag hangs at the Mixed Greens Gallery in New York. Clark says it looks like it's slowly coming undone.
Most people don't really think about how cloth is woven. And then secondly, this cloth is woven and then pieced together to make the Confederate flag. So, you know, there's a white cloth that is stitched to a blue cloth that is stitched to a red cloth, and then stars are stitched on top. When people were unraveling it with me, they were sort of understanding the complexity of cloth itself, which I think is akin to understanding the complexity of the history of racism in our nation.
I've heard you describe this process of unraveling the Confederate flag as a somewhat meditative one, and I was hoping you could share a little bit more about that.
This is an incredibly contentious symbol, especially with the shootings in South Carolina. I wish this work weren't as relevant as it is, but it is as relevant as it is. And that's heartbreaking, but it just is evidence that there's more work to be done and more work that has to be done at many levels.
Let me ask you a question that we've been contemplating a lot in Charlotte, and people in South Carolina have been contemplating even more. Where is the most appropriate place for a Confederate flag to be?
I have to agree with the president on this one. I think that to get rid of all Confederate flags would be an erasure of our history, and we would be destined to repeat it. In fact, we're not doing so good at not repeating it right now. So I believe that the Confederate flag belongs in museums. I've lived in Richmond now for about 10 years. And quite recently, I went to the Museum of the Confederacy. One of the photographs that I took in the museum was of a threadbare Confederate flag, and it was behind glass. So here was this threadbare silk Confederate flag with my black female face reflected in a mirror of the glass that was protecting the flag. And that actually compelled me in part to start this project. So yes, they belong in museums. And well, obviously, I think they belong in some artworks, too.
Speaking with her a year later, she says she's gotten a lot of feedback about her work, some of it good.
There are some people who really understood the metaphor that I was working on.
And some negative.
And then there were people who were really hateful in terms of their response to the work, as if by taking a flag apart thread by thread was tantamount to killing an already dead ancestor.
Clark says she got called every name you could imagine. This negative response did not surprise her. After all, she's unraveling perhaps the most contentious piece of cloth in American history. The Confederate flag used in Unraveling is cotton, common material used in Civil War battle flags. Cotton itself, of course, has its own complicated history, being a cash crop picked by slaves. As an African-American artist who lives in Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, she wondered what would it be like to unravel a nylon flag, a more durable material used in flags today. What resulted from that curiosity was a piece called Untitled, a completely unraveled nylon Confederate flag that hangs limply from a flagpole attached to a wall in her studio.
You're still left with a very, very distinct flag. So that even though it's been unraveled, the image of the battle flag of the Confederacy is very much present. So I guess that is timely.
Even though it's the same action of unraveling, the unraveling of the Confederate symbol in modern material sends a different message.
The nylon is easy to unravel, but the image, because of the modern material, has more staying power than the cotton. Insert your own artistic interpretation here.
The murders at Mother Emanuel and the aftermath will invariably mean different things to different people. Some will see it as a hate crime, a powerful moment of forgiveness, a grim reminder of what it means to be Black in America. Standing at Mother Emanuel's pulpit eulogizing the slain pastor who had long shepherded this flock, President Barack Obama told the country he hoped the deaths would not be in vain.
For too long, we've been blind to the way past injustices continue to shape the present.
That's right.
Perhaps we see that now. Perhaps this tragedy causes us to ask some tough questions about how we can permit so many of our children to languish in poverty or attend dilapidated schools or grow up without prospects for a job or for career. Perhaps it causes us to examine what we're doing to cause some of our children to hate.
Some will heed this call, but there's something inevitable in tragedy. It's easy for people's attention to shift to the next tragedy, the next trial, the next time hate lashes out at humanity. Then, as now, some will try to make sense of the senseless with their eyes closed in prayer. This program was written and produced by Tom Bullock, with reporting by Sarah D'Elia and Mark Rumsey. Special thanks to Alexandra Olgan of South Carolina Public Radio. The show was edited by Greg Collard. I'm Gwendolyn Glynn.